welcome to episode 115 of the People's History of Ideas podcast. Last episode, we discussed Zhou Enlai's letter to Mao Zedong and Zhu De, in which Zhou gave some orders regarding how the Fourth Red Army should dispose of its forces. He specifically ordered Mao to disperse the army, and in which he ordered Mao and Zhu to go to Shanghai and leave behind the army that they had built. This episode, I want to discuss Mao's reply to Zhou of April 5th, 1929. This letter, which is formally a letter from the Front Committee to the Central Committee, and so not officially a letter from Mao to Zhou, is an extremely important document in Communist Party history. Substantial parts of the letter are reproduced in Mao's letter to Lin Biao of January 5th, 1930, parts of which later were included in Mao's selected works as the document, A Single Spark Can Start a Prairie Fire. And this April 5th, 1929 letter was included in the document collection that was put together in Yan'an in 1941, titled After the Sixth Party Congress, and as such was part of the key set of materials studied within the party during the process through which Mao established his ideological leadership, beginning with a campaign to study party history, and in particular the history of inter-party debates over key aspects of revolutionary strategy and policy more broadly, in other words, the history of what is called line struggle within the party. And then this campaign to study party history led into the rectification campaign of 1942 to 1944, which established Mao's ideological leadership of the party. So let's look at this letter, beginning with the very long opening paragraph. Quote, to the Central Committee, on April 3rd at Ruijin, we received your letter of February 7th, which had been forwarded to us by the Fujian Provincial Committee. The Central Committee's letter makes too pessimistic an appraisal of the objective situation and of the subjective forces. The third suppression campaign against the Jingangshan represented the high watermark of the counter-revolutionary tide. But there it stopped, and since then the counter-revolutionary tide has gradually receded, while the revolutionary tide has gradually risen. Although our party's fighting capacity and organizational strength have been weakened to the extent described by the Central Committee, they will be rapidly restored, and the passivity among comrades in the party will quickly disappear as the counter-revolutionary tide gradually ebbs. The masses will certainly come over to us. Butcherism, this is a term that was used to describe the Kuomintang policy of just massacring entire populations. Butcherism only serves to drive the fish into deep waters, and reformism no longer has any appeal to the masses. The illusions of the masses about the Kuomintang will assuredly be soon dissipated. In the circumstances which will arise, no other party will be able to compete with the Communist Party in winning over the masses. The political line and the organizational line laid down by the Sixth Congress are entirely correct. The current stage of the revolution is democratic and not socialist, and the present task of the party is to win over the masses and not to stage immediate armed insurrections. Nevertheless, the revolution is developing swiftly, and we should adopt a positive spirit in our propaganda about and preparations for armed insurrection. In the present chaotic situation, we can lead the masses only if we have positive slogans and a positive spirit. Only by having such a spirit can the party recover its fighting capacity. We feel that the party committed the error of adventurism in the past, and now it has a rather marked liquidationist tendency in some places. The party branches in the localities that we have passed through in western Fujian and southern Jiangxi had very low combat morale and had lightly let go many opportunities for battle. The masses are vast and also revolutionary, but the party branches are not taking the lead. The examples of western Fujian and southern Jiangxi make us wonder whether there are similar phenomena elsewhere. So we have to oppose the evil tendency toward adventurism and commandism, but we must also energetically guard against the tendency toward liquidationism and immobilism. Proletarian leadership is the sole key to the victory of the revolution. Building up the party's proletarian basis and establishing party branches in industrial enterprises in key areas are the greatest organizational tasks for the party at present. But at the same time, the development of the struggle in the countryside, the establishment of Soviets in small areas, and the creation and expansion of the Red Army are prerequisites for aiding the struggle in the cities and hastening the revolutionary upsurge. The greatest mistake would therefore be to abandon the struggle in the cities and sink into rural guerrillaism. But in our opinion, it is also a mistake, if any of our party members hold such views, to fear the development of the power of the peasants, lest it outstrip the workers' leadership and become detrimental to the revolution. For the revolution in semi-colonial China will fail only if the peasant struggle is deprived of the leadership of the workers. It will never suffer just because the peasant struggle develops in such a way as to become more powerful than the workers. The Sixth Congress has pointed out the mistake of neglecting the peasant revolution. And this letter from the Central Committee, the idea, develop a vast struggle everywhere in the rural areas, represents the only correct view. End quote. So here, Mao engages the letter from Zhou Enlai on the level of overall line and strategy. And he repeatedly gives lip service to the overall line as articulated by the Central Committee, while indicating his own disagreements as if they were simply complementary aspects of the same line, or corrections to unfortunate misinterpretations of what is certainly the party and Comintern's correct overall line. In particular, we see here in incipient form an articulation of Mao's conception of what proletarian leadership of the Chinese Revolution means, as opposed to the Central Committee's view. As we know, at the time, the Central Committee saw the party's main task as rebuilding the party's influence within urban areas among the industrial working class and recruiting large numbers of industrial workers into the party. While the party had made some remarkable gains among urban workers before the Kuomintang turned on the communists in 1927, since then, repression had largely wiped out the party's worker membership. Mao, on the other hand, didn't see a problem with there being vastly more peasants involved in the revolution, and even with the rural struggle being much more dynamic than the urban struggle, so long as, ultimately, this struggle was being led by the working class, or, meaning the same thing, under proletarian leadership. Now, what proletarian leadership meant concretely was, of course, a major question. Clearly, at this time, the Central Committee felt that this meant achieving some sort of critical mass of worker members of the Communist Party and placing them in leading positions in the party. We saw that this was a major concern at the Sixth Party Congress back in episode 106, and this was the major reason why the ineffectual Shang Zhongfa was made General Secretary at the end of that Congress. And this was also a major way in which the Soviet Union approached the question of establishing proletarian leadership. With the working class background of, for example, Nikita Khrushchev, who succeeded Stalin as the leader of the Soviet Union in the 1950s, playing a key role in Khrushchev's rise in the Soviet leadership. For Mao, ultimately, proletarian leadership would come to mean the leading role of the ideas corresponding to the class interests of the proletariat as an international class, which meant that the role of concrete, actual, living workers was not as important as the ideas guiding the overall revolutionary process, no matter who was carrying out the actual revolutionary activities. Now, Mao doesn't say that outright here, and I think at this time that he had not fully articulated this idea in his own mind. And let's be clear, how to actually apply this idea in practice is much more complicated than stating it in the relatively simple terms that I just did here. But we can see Mao carefully articulating his disagreement with the dominant position in the Chinese Communist Party and in the Comintern in this opening paragraph of the April 5th letter. Okay, let's see how Mao continues in this letter. All right, this paragraph is even longer than the last one, but I'm going to intersperse some comments in the middle of it. Quote, "The Central Committee asks us to divide our forces into very small units and disperse them over the countryside and to withdraw Zhu De and Mao Zedong from the army, thus concealing the major targets. All this with the aim of preserving the Red Army and arousing the masses." And here, as we discussed last episode, Mao correctly, accurately sums up what he had been ordered to do by Zhou Enlai. Continuing with the letter. "This is a kind of ideal view. In the winter of 1927 to 1928, we did start to plan to disperse our forces over the countryside, with each company or battalion operating on its own and adopting guerrilla tactics in order to arouse the masses while trying not to present a target for the enemy. We have tried this many times but have failed every time. The reasons are, one, most of the soldiers of the Red Army come from other areas and have a background different from that of the local Red Guards. The peasants in Ningguang and other counties of the Hunan Jiangxi border area are willing to serve only in the local Red Guard units, but not in the Red Army. Therefore, in the Red Army, one can hardly find any peasants from the Hunan Jiangxi border area. The Red Army is made up of veterans from the National Revolutionary Army, the peasant army from Luoyang, Pingjiang, and southern Hunan, and prisoners of war from the past. Two, division into small units results in weak leadership and organization and inability to cope with adverse circumstances, which easily lead to defeat. Three, the units are liable to be crushed by the enemy one by one. Because of the division of forces, the 5th Army in Pingjiang and Luoyang counties and the 4th Army in the border area and in Hunan have been defeated 5 times. 4. The more adverse the circumstances, the greater the need for concentration and for the leaders to be resolute in struggle, because only thus can we have internal unity to resist the enemy. Only in favorable circumstances is it advisable to divide our forces for guerrilla operations, and it is only then that the leaders need to stay with the ranks all the time, as they must in adverse circumstances. This last time, when we left the Jinggangshan and marched towards southern Jiangxi and western Fujian, because our troops were centralized and the leading organs, the front committee, and the leaders, Zhu and Mao, attitudes were unwavering, not only was the enemy unable to do anything to us, but their losses were greater than their gains, and our gains were greater than our losses. Our 2 victories in Ningdu and Tingzhou counties completely wiped out the combat effectiveness of the local bullies, Guo's and Liu's brigades, resulting in the current mass mobilization in southern Jiangxi and western Fujian. Without the centralization of the army and sound leadership, this could not have been done. The tactics we have derived from the struggle of the past 3 years are indeed different from any other tactics, ancient or modern, Chinese or foreign. With our tactics, the masses can be aroused for struggle on an ever-broadening scale, and no enemy, however powerful, can cope with us. Ours are guerrilla tactics. They consist mainly of the following points. Divide our forces to arouse the masses, concentrate our forces to deal with the enemy. The enemy advances, we retreat. The enemy camps, we harass. The enemy tires, we attack. The enemy retreats, we pursue. And just as an aside, this line that begins with the enemy advances, we retreat, and ends with enemy retreats, we pursue, is known in Chinese as the 16-character formula, because each one of those four clauses, has four characters to it. And this, in this letter, is actually the first time that this very famous formulation of Mao Zedong's and Zhu De's for sort of the basic strategy of guerrilla warfare and a basic strategy that they would follow during the course of the Chinese Revolution. This is the first time that this is put on paper. It had actually been coined all the way back in May 1928 by Mao and Zhu, but this is the first sort of historical appearance in writing of this formulation. So that gives you a sense of just how significant this letter is. All right, back to the letter. To extend stable base areas, employ the policy of advancing in waves. When pursued by a powerful enemy, employ the policy of circling around. Arouse the largest numbers of the masses in the shortest possible time and by the best possible methods. So, in this second paragraph of the letter, Mao gives a concrete response to Zhou's orders, indicating why they won't work based on the experience of the Red Army. He does this in a way that highly concentrates about a year and a half's intense political and military experience, and does so in a way that both expresses the concrete situation that Mao and Zhou are debating, and also expresses what are, I think, universal guidelines for how a communist leadership might utilize the forces under its command in both a military and political sense. And as I mentioned just a second ago, he also articulates here for the first time in a major internal party communication what would turn out to be one of the guiding principles of guerrilla warfare in China and elsewhere. In the next paragraph, Mao gives further concrete details on how the Red Army organized its work, moving back and forth between concentrating its forces to fight the enemy and dispersing to conduct political work and to mobilize the masses. Quote, "These tactics are just like casting a net. At any moment, we should be able to cast it or draw it in. We cast it wide to win over the masses and draw it in to deal with the enemy. Such are the tactics we have used for the past 3 years. When we were in the Hunan-Jiangxi border area, once we had pulled the forces together and defeated the enemy, we were able to scatter and work for 2 to 3 weeks in several big teams, and then each big team could again be subdivided, until the enemy once more marshaled his forces to attack us, at which point we would get together again to defeat the enemy, then scatter again to work. This time when the enemy pursued us, we used the spiral guerrilla tactics and went through a vast area and mobilized vast masses. Whenever we came to a place, we would stay a minimum of half a day and a maximum of 5 days. First, we conducted propaganda on a large scale. The press propaganda team and oral propaganda teams under the political department are based on the company. 2 teams per company and 3 people per team. Along the march and wherever we went, propaganda was immediately conducted everywhere. Then we distributed money and goods, grain, clothing, and tools owned by big landlords and reactionary elements, and we went ahead with organizing, party branches, underground workers' unions, and underground peasants' unions. Our techniques of working with the masses have greatly improved. The Red Army now is not purely a combat force. Its main function is, rather, to mobilize the masses. Combat is only a means. The time we spend on combat, as compared with the time we spend on mass work, stands in a proportion of 1 to 10. The army today is different from that in the days of Ye and He. Remember, Ye Ting and He Long were the leaders of the Red Army after the Nanchang Uprising. They were the guys who led that army south on the southern expedition that we talked about a while ago in past episodes. The only occupation of the army of Ye and He was to fight. This would not work today. It would not have survived. At no time can the Red Army survive without a united leading organization for the party and the army. Otherwise, it will fall into anarchy and will certainly fail." We have at this point read almost the first half of the letter. Now, The letter goes on, and if you're very interested in following the development of the Chinese revolutionary process in all its minutiae, it's definitely worth tracking it down and reading the whole thing. But for our purposes here, we've covered the bulk of the substance of Mao's argument against Zhou's order that the army reorganize itself in a dispersed form. Now, as for the order that Mao and Zhu report to Shanghai, Mao dispenses with that in a very brief but also logical manner. Quote, "At present, the party's leading organ is the Front Committee, with Mao Zedong as secretary, and the military commanding organ is the headquarters, with Zhu De as chief of the army. If the Central Committee needs Zhu and Mao for other assignments, please send us capable replacements for them." So, in refusing to head off to Shanghai, and in refusing to carry out Zhou's orders that he reorganize the Red Army, we see Mao once again defying direct orders from higher-level party organs. Now, Mao makes very reasonable arguments against the orders that he was given. I think that it's indisputable that history has shown that Mao knew very much better what to do in developing the Red Army and in unfolding guerrilla warfare than anyone at the party center did. But we also see Mao, once again, pushing against the limits of what could be considered acceptable behavior in the context of democratic centralist norms. These norms were conditioned by immediate political circumstances. When Zhou had given his orders, things had looked very bleak for the communists in the Hunan-Jiangxi border region. But when Mao received the orders, he was riding high on a series of victories in the Jiangxi-Fujian border region, and he had enough political and military capital to make the case that the orders he had been given were wrong and to have his argument listened to. In fact, even before Mao's letter reached the Central Committee in Shanghai, news of his victories had reached the party center and was causing Zhou Enlai to revise his views. During a meeting on April 4th, Zhou Enlai commented that the order to remove Mao and Zhu from the Red Army leadership while, quote, "correct in principle," end quote, should be reconsidered in light of the current reality. And on April 7th, he sent out a new letter to Mao stating that if Mao and Zhu, quote, "could not come for the time being, the Central Committee would like to see the Front Committee send a capable comrade to discuss the matter," end quote. So, this issue of the party center finding some way of exercising more control over Mao is not going to go away. But for the time being, Mao and Zhu De will be free to attempt their plan for the communist conquest of southern Jiangxi that Mao had laid out in his March 20th letter to the Central Committee that we discussed two episodes ago. All right, that's where we will leave things for now. And just a short update on what I've been up to. I've been going back and forth between working on this Communism and World History textbook that I'm writing and working on future episodes of this podcast. In going back and reading a bunch of stuff on Karl Marx for that chapter of the textbook, I found a book that I think people who listen to this podcast would really enjoy. I'm sure that some of you already found this book long before I did, but for those of you who haven't heard about it yet, I want to recommend checking out Michael Heinrich's biography of Karl Marx, the first volume of which has been published in English by Monthly Review Press, titled Karl Marx and the Birth of Modern Society. It only takes Marx up through 1841, so I ended the book really wanting more very badly. But if you're looking for a very dense and sympathetic biographical treatment of the very young Karl Marx and the world that he was moving in, I think that you will really like the book. All right, that's it for now. Be well.